All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to DevOps, Increasing Application Lifecycle Efficiencies with Microsoft Visual Studio and System Center. Our goal here is to make titles as long as possible. We understand that we are the last session standing between you and free drinks, so hopefully we can keep you entertained and keep you awake until that happens. My name is Larry Guger. I'm with the Visual Studio team, flew in from Seattle, and this is my partner, Charlie.
Yep. I'm Charlie Satterfield. I'm Program Manager in the System Center Cloud and Data Center Management team.
So today what we want to do is we want to take you on a bit of a journey on what led up to this DevOps thing. So we're going to talk a bit about philosophy and some of the process and the motivations that got us into this whole DevOps thing. And then we're going to switch modes after we talk and show you some slides, and then we're going to get into demos, with the majority of the session being demos. So we've got this whole concept of DevOps, but there's something that led us here initially. And a lot of it began with the concept of Agile. And I've got up there sort of a one simple sentence on what I use to describe Agile. And Agile is all about responding to change. So here, who's doing Agile development? Okay, so a good number of you. How many of you are devs? Okay. How many are IT pro, ops guys? Okay. All so right. This is, I think in New Orleans it was the other way around. It was mostly ops guys and a few devs. So this is a nice change up. Cool. So the reason we got into Agile a few years back was because the waterfall process was having a lot of challenges. Right? People were developing these very large requirements up front. They spent a long time creating them. They'd hand them off to the dev team. The dev team would disappear for a couple of years. And then they'd come up with an application. Right? And say, here you go. And the guys that wrote the requirements would kind of go, no, that's not what I want. Right? That's not really what I wrote, and that's not what I intended. So there's this disconnect. So Agile tried to address a lot of that by saying, well, developers, you need to talk to the business much more often. You need to communicate. And you need to be able to respond to change. So let's build some software in very small increments. Let's put out a small little piece, get the business to look at it and comment on it, and then you can make changes much more rapidly and much more easily. And by the time you get to the end product several years down the road, it's much closer to what the business actually wanted. Now, that's all about philosophy. It's all about process. It's all about how your culture works within your organization. And it has nothing to do with tools. Now, of course, to support making rapid changes and altering your software fairly frequently, we implemented a lot of things like test-driven development. And we have tools to support that. Continuous integration. Let's get the code merging very frequently. And there's tools to support that. So there's a lot of tools and products that came out to help support the Agile mindset. But the real driving factor for agility was not about tools. It's about delivering business value. The next thing that sort of came along, and is still a lot of the wave that's pushing things today, are a lot of the lean concepts. Anybody here working on lean? Right, so we've got a couple of hands. And I know out of the Scandinavian countries, that was one of the real originators for a lot of the lean concepts. And that's my sort of two-word summary of what lean is all about, and it's reducing waste. And it's reducing waste in your process. Now, of course, this is originating out of Toyota Manufacturing Systems, where they were looking at reducing inventory. You build 10,000 bumpers, you take the first one off the pile and you attach it to car, and if it doesn't quite fit, you've got 9,999 bumpers that you need to rework. So reducing the level of inventory to something much more manageable, like 10 bumpers at a time, if you find the first one doesn't fit, then you've only got 9 to either throw away or rework, and you can go and change the process that's feeding you those bad bumpers to begin with. Now, with software development, it's very similar in the concept of work in progress. So you'll hear this referred to as your WIP limits. So how much work do you have flowing through your pipeline, through your requirements, through your development, through your testing, through to delivery into production? You want to keep as much work in progress as minimal as possible. Now, back in Seattle, right, we have Starbucks on every other corner, right? I think we each have a Starbucks in our office, right? Because that's how Starbucks works back in the U.S. And Starbucks has really embraced lean as well. And you'll see that when you walk into a Starbucks, and if the line is very long walking up to the cash register, they'll shift the people behind the counter to have more people working the tills and the cash registers so that they can get those people through. So it's reducing basically that work in progress. If the line is longer where people are waiting to get their drinks, they'll move more people over to work on producing the drinks to get that bottleneck reduced as much as possible. Same concept applies in software. If your developers pick up a user story, assuming you're using user stories, start building those, hand them off to QA, and you keep having a whole lot of those, and you've got a lot of really fast developers, or maybe you have a very large development team, what you find is now you've got all these user stories stacked up, waiting for your testers to get through them and test them all. Some of the concepts with Lean are all about, well, if that's where your bottleneck is, you want to start to shift your resources so that you can start to get a lot of the work that's being bottlenecked by testers through there faster. A lot of this is managed using Kanban boards. So that's sort of how we've taken some of the concepts from the manufacturing and are using them in software. And this is where the tools start to come in. But it's not about tools, it's all about the process and the ideas. So we want to reduce the amount of work that's in progress, get more people working on where the bottlenecks are, and address your bottlenecks. So that's where your waste comes in. So now the next thing that's coming up is this DevOps thing. Now DevOps has, I think we still are trying to nail down what the real one-liner, that might, the two words that I could have put up there are for DevOps. Most of the industry has agreed, and I think we're coming to a consensus. But what I want to talk about is what are some of the drivers behind DevOps and why this is starting to come up now. And really what we want to do with DevOps is now start to pull in the operations guys. Large enterprises, you usually have a silo between the development team and the operations team. And there's a barrier. You have different objectives, right? The development team wants to push out new software as fast as possible. Operations team wants to keep their systems up and running at near as close to 100% as possible. And the way to do that is no changes. Once it's running, don't touch the system, and you're fine. And the devs say, but I want to change the system, right? So you've got these real opposing goals between the two systems. But you need to start looking at the business, right? Why did we move to Agile? Because we need to react to the business faster. Why did we start bringing in a lot of these lean concepts? Because the business is demanding that you get this stuff through the pipeline faster, eliminate the waste. So both of those initiatives were driven by business reasons. DevOps is the same thing. There's just some new drivers out there that are motivating us into this DevOps space where it's about getting things into production as quickly as possible. Now, me as a business guy, why do I want stuff into production faster? Well, there's a whole lot of things that are motivating me to try and get new solutions out there. Right, there's new technology, right? My phone talks to my car. That didn't happen a few years back, but now that that does, I've got opportunities to create new software that operates in my car in conjunction with my phone, in conjunction with satellites and online services. So I've got business opportunities that didn't exist before. With all of the web and the mobile and all of these things, I can access consumers much more easily as a corporation, and as a consumer, I can access corporations much more easily. If I'm a company like Adidas, and I want to sell my shoes, why should I have to sell them through a store? I should just be able to sell them online directly to the customer. Cut out that middleman. As a customer, I want to be able to access the company directly and cut out that middleman as well. So we should be able to enable all of these things. Now, cloud computing, of course, is doing all sorts of wonderful things. I should be able to take advantage of that. But a lot of the crux, and a lot of it sort of comes down to that last box, and that's compete velocity. It doesn't matter what size you are, you're competing with everybody in the world. So we've got real small shops. Me and Charlie, with our little app in our basement that we're writing, we can compete with the largest corporations in the world as long as we've got that right business thing. And we see that happen all the time, right? These small little startups that next thing you know, they're being bought by Yahoo. Because I don't need to worry about buying a room to hold racks and racks of servers to deal with that scale. I just need the idea. and I can spin it up. So with the proliferation of mobile devices, connected devices, direct to consumer, there's all of these opportunities, and large enterprises need to worry about the little guys as much as the little guys can keep an eye on the big guys. So all of this means I need to start pushing updates into production as fast as possible. I need to be reacting to what the customers are seeing and how they're behaving with my apps as rapidly as possible so that I don't lose my business share. I think you just blew up the microphone.
I think I did. I'd ask if this is on, but I think I've already proven that.
You guys awake now?
Yes. Pardon. So everything that Larry just talked about, from an ops perspective, it scares me. He wants to move fast. He wants to move things to production very quickly. And from an operations perspective, I need to be concerned about what capabilities do I have to enable that concept to production flow in a quick time scale. Some of the things that allow me to do that are the improvements that we have in operating systems and virtualization technologies. We now have things like the public and private cloud that I can leverage to quickly be able to spin up new environments. However, even with these new technologies, we still have challenges. Now, some of those challenges, you may experience these. You may have isolated workflows between dev and operations. I know we do, and we're only a two-man shop. I work out of operations manager and system center, and Larry works out of Team Foundation Server. So we have our own tool set that we're using to track our work and identify issues. Next, from an operations perspective, it's difficult for me to detect issues in productions before my users do at times. And if my users are detecting issues in production, they're probably going elsewhere. They're not going to notify me that there's an issue. They're just going to take their business elsewhere. And then once I discover there's an issue, it's sometimes hard for me to debug that issue without taking. So I usually have to take a server out of rotation. And we only have two servers. That really decreases my availability, my reliability. Anyway, it may be very hard for me to replicate that production issue when I take it out of rotation. It may take me months to actually replicate the issue, nail down what the actual problem was, and hand that information over to my dev team and Larry.
So once I've gotten the information from Charlie, you get the bug report. So somebody's recorded this bug. Charlie's given me what he can, so whether it's IIS logs or application logs. Quite often that's not enough to really be able to fix the bug in a timely manner, right? And our goal here is we want to be able to reduce MTTR, right? So I've got that acronym there, right? It's the mean time to resolution. How long does it take you from the time you were first notified that you have a problem with your application to when you get it fixed and back into production? And that back into production is really key, right? There's one thing to even figure out what the problem is. Next thing is to fix it. But once I've got the fix on my desktop, how long does it take me to get it into production? Of course, trying to reproduce these in my development environment is really hard, right? I mean, we had the old joke several years ago, you know, it works fine on my box, right? Well, it still holds true in a lot of cases, right? I've got the app here. I've got my code. Everything works fine. I can't figure out why Charlie's seeing this problem in his production servers. So it can be tough to get that reproducible data back. And then, of course, I've already spoken to how there can be this path to production, which can be very time-consuming. We need to figure out when's the right time. There's all of these manual tests that need to occur. So we looked at the whole life cycle, and we identified these six as real key core problems that we at Microsoft wanted to go in and address. So we're going to look at how we're addressing these challenges with the tools that we have available today.
All right.
There we go.
So let's switch over. Great. All right, so we recently deployed some new features of our application, and I'm going to pretend I'm a user, and I'm going to go out and explore this new feature and see what's going on. We deployed a new reports feature, and when I navigate to this, my end users apparently are encountering an issue with this page. Now, from an IT operations standpoint, this is your nightmare. You don't want this to happen. You don't want to have your end users discover this issue and go elsewhere. So as an operations team, what have I put in place to try and help me discover these issues quickly? So using System Center Ops Manager, I've done a few things. I've created a web app availability monitor for this app. And to do that, I went into the authoring workspace. And I have my monitor here. If I open up, I can show you the properties. This is new in 2012, and it allows me to actually monitor multiple URLs or multiple pages using a single monitor. I can go ahead and click on the Add button here, and I can import a CSV file, or I can manually type these in. Now, on the next screen, I can select where I want to actually monitor this from. Now, with 2012 RTM, the only option was really to monitor using internal watcher nodes. And in this case, we're using a resource pool that's actually located here in Madrid. And typically, we use a resource pool with at least two gateways in it so that we have high availability around that resource pool. Now, with SP1 and the launch of Global Service Monitor, we actually have the ability to monitor those same pages from external locations as well. So if I click the Add button here, and then click search, I'm returned a list of 16 different points of presence around the globe that I can add into this monitor very quickly, and I could start to see what the user perspective is from those various areas. So since my app is actually running locally on this VM, I'm not going to make a change here, but I will show you the configuration of these is on the last page, or the last tab. I can actually increase or decrease the frequency of this test. If I'm running this from an external GSM watcher node, the most frequently that I can actually test this or execute a test is once every 5 minutes. If I'm running solely from an internal resource pool or agent, I can actually increase that frequency. It can test once every 30 seconds, once every minute. It really is up to what my business requires. And then I can change some of the test timeout instructions, as well as I can vary the number of consecutive times this particular monitor should fail before it alerts me. And in this case, I'm pretty wary of what's going on with my site, so I actually want to be alerted each time it fails. So I'll cancel out of here. Now, once I got that monitor up and running, I navigate back to the monitoring workspace and look underneath application monitoring, web application availability monitoring, at the web app status view. And I can see here my page is healthy, but I know I have an issue. Some of the other views that you can look at here include a summary dashboard map, which will actually bring up the locations that I'm executing this test from. And apparently it still has my old location in there. If you couldn't tell, I ran this demo in New Orleans as well. However, if I had GSM watcher nodes, I would see all 16 of them and a red or green health status indicator. What's concerning to me is the app shows it's healthy right now. I'm testing it using a web app monitor, but it's not actually detecting that the user is hitting an exception that our code is handling. Right? So if the code didn't handle that exception and it actually bubbled up and threw an exception up to IE, it would show as unhealthy. But in this case, we're not going to get that. So I've set up another monitor. I've set up an application performance monitor that hopefully should be able to give me more information about the health of this application. So again, in the authoring workspace, what I've done is create this monitor, which is very simple to do once you have the IIS and APM management packs imported into Operations Manager. it'll detect all your .NET IIS-hosted .NET websites and web services, and you'll be able to select from a list of all those detected applications. In this case, I only have one application on this web server, and so that's the only application it would detect. Now, there can be cases where it would not detect an application. Perhaps your root folder for that application is empty. You can add overrides to be able to discover applications that don't fall in the standard model. Now, once I've set up this monitor, what it does is set up a very lightweight .NET profiler on my production web server. So as the users are actually running through the pages, I'm getting all the details as far as performance and application failure exceptions collected and sent back into Operations Manager. And there are two portals that you can use to view that data, one of which is the App Diagnostics portal. And you can see here, I'm hitting quite a few exceptions on this website. I've got some application failures and a couple performance, but let me group them by problem type because maybe I have fewer problems. Group by problem. Well, it's got to load one more time. All right, let me go ahead and group by problem this time. As you can see here, I actually only have three individual problems, and I get a count of how many times my users have actually hit this issue. And you can see here I've got two different application failures, and one of these is a null reference exception. At this point, I could drill into these and actually get a view of what the stack was in the exception, including some of the parameters. I could, at this point, download the IntelliTrace log, save it off, hand it off to Larry. I could communicate about all this through email, dump a Word doc to a file share. But what I prefer to do is have an integrated way to actually send the information from Operation Manager to his tool set, Team Foundation Server. And I can do this using the Team Foundation Server connector. Now, if I open up Operation Manager, and let me go back into the monitoring view, underneath .NET monitoring, I'll look at the active alerts for my application. And you can see here I've got one here that's in a resolution state of assigned engineering. Larry apparently already has one issue in his queue. So when we set up the Team Foundation connector, it actually imports a new template type. It's called an operational issue into Team Foundation Server. And in order to actually get any of these issues over to Team Foundation Server, all I need to do is simply select them and set their resolution state to assigned to engineering. Now that I've done this, the workflow that occurs in the background will create those operational issues over in Team Foundation Server, including all the details. It'll actually either attach, if you've created an override, it will attach the IntelliTrace files to the actual operational issue, or it will actually link to the file share where they're stored. Really kind of depends on where you'd like to store those. But at this point, as an operational IT guy, I've gone as far as I can with this issue, and I've now assigned it over to my dev team. So I'm going to hand off to Larry so that he can run his morning triage and start investigating this issue.
All right. So one of the things as a dev, I don't like looking at these tools, right? So this stuff that Charlie works with, not my gag, right? Operational stuff, just I don't like it. It scares me. I try and stay away. This is where I live, right? Visual Studio is my tool. Keep me there. I'm happy. So the first thing that I need to do when I come in the morning is I need to check and see what's been going on. So within Visual Studio, I'm just going to go and take a look at the work items. Now, what I've done here is I've created a couple of queries that I've pinned going against this operational issue work item type that Charlie was talking about, right? So this is just another work item type that gets installed into TFS when we install that Team Foundation Server connector for System Center. And what I can do now is I can see there are 8 operational issues that have come in total. 3 of them are closed, 4 new ones, and 1 resolved. And I've got these 4 new ones. So those are the 4 that we were just seeing within System Center. So if I take a look at this query, I can see I've got a few different ones, and these are all the ones that he just assigned over to me. If you notice the IDs listed here, 5, 6, 7, and 8, if we just bounce back to System Center, and if we scroll over, this ticket ID that it's showing in System Center is the work item ID contained within TFS. So we already have a link between the two tools. Charlie can say, hey, I assigned this stuff over to you. What's the status on this, you know, this particular issue? And he can say, it's work item 7. So I can go directly back into Visual Studio, and I can query under the work item ID and pull back the exact same thing. Now, the one that I'm interested in looking at first is the one that had that null reference exception. So this is the one on top. This is the one that had been previously assigned to engineering. So I can take a look at this one. Let me just make it a little larger. So we can see a short description. So this is taken from the exact same data. See a bit of a longer description down here. I've also got this URL that I can click on. And this is just taking me to the exact same portal that Charlie was looking at. I'm not interested in that because that's just not where I like to be. I like to stay in Visual Studio. So the other thing that we're seeing here is we have an IntelliTrace file associated with this work item. Now, like Charlie said, this is a configurable option such that it can either be a link or an attachment. It all depends on how you want to manage your storage space. If it's a link, then this is going to link to the location that you've configured in System Center to drop these files. So typically what you'd want to do in that case is have them drop to a file share where the development team has access so that I can just open it directly from here. If you don't have that kind of security openness or you don't have those capabilities, you can link it, or pardon me, attach it to the work item so it'll show up as an attachment. In that case, the IntelliTrace file is going to be stored in your Team Foundation data store. So it sort of becomes, how do you want to set up your security for access? Where do you want these files stored? Since this one's a link, I'm just going to double-click on that, and this is going to open up my IntelliTrace file, and you'll notice that it actually spun up a new instance of Visual Studio that I need to sign into. Now, you don't require 2013 to do this. This works perfectly fine on 2012. What happens is I have to go through all this. What happens is it's going to default to the newest version of Visual Studio that you have installed. So if you've got 2012, it would open up in 2012. Okay, let's get rid of that. So what we can see here is here's my IntelliTrace summary page. Now, this is the same IntelliTrace summary page experience that we shipped in 2010, 2012, and we'll ship again in 2013 like you're seeing here. And it contains a single exception. So this is the exception that occurred in my web application when Charlie went to that reports page. Right, so I've got a global exception handler in my web application, like everybody does, because you don't want to show that yellow screen of death to your customers. So you put up a nice friendly error message. Not that that's really any better, but it at least hides the stack trace from your customers. Now, the way the APM works within System Center, it's going to be monitoring for any exceptions that are occurring within my application. When it detects an exception, it's going to record it, and it's going to capture a bunch of information. Now, when I click on this, I get my call stack, and I can look at this, and I go, yep, there's my Fabricam fiber code on the call stack. I definitely know this is a problem within my code, and I can start debugging. Just scrolled a little bit off there. Now, one thing hopefully you noticed here is I had spun up a brand new instance of Visual Studio. I did not have a solution loaded. Double-clicking, or when I started debugging on that exception, it loaded the code for me. So I was able to resolve to the code. Now, there's a few settings that you need to configure to be able to ensure this will happen, and I'll show you how those are configured a little bit later when we get to the build definitions. So from here, I understand the line of code where my exception was thrown. And I can dig into this a little bit further, and I can realize where was the null object. Now, depending on your workflow, maybe this requires getting a copy of the database, talking to your business users to understand what are the requirements when there is no customer object. How am I supposed to handle that? So I talk to my business, and we say, oh, well, you know, there are going to be cases where there's a null customer provided, because these are customers that are associated with employees, because I was looking at my employees' report. Well, in those cases, just return a message saying, you know, no customer found. All right. So I've investigated this a little bit, and I'm going to move on to fixing. So I'm going to get out of 2013, because we're still using 2012 to do our daily development. And I've done some investigation, so I'm going to take the state of this operational issue, and I'm going to mark it as accepted. Now, the state change within my work item that I'm doing within VS, where I'm comfortable, is also going to be reflected in System Center. So Charlie can look in System Center at any time to see that I've actually accepted this bug, and I'm working on it.
I'm very glad that you're following our processes.
It doesn't happen often, no. So enjoy it when it does. Okay, so there's my operational issue. I can go with that. Let's go to my Solution Explorer. I don't have my solution open yet. So I'm just going to open up my Fabricam Fiber code. And due to the magic of demos, I happen to have the right file open in front of me. How often does that happen, right? Yeah, no, not very often. Okay, so here's my line of code. This is the problem. Now, the first thing I want to do, because I'm a good Agile developer, right? All of those Agile and all of those lean practices, that you still carry all of that stuff forward. So I've got a problem. What I want to do is I want to reproduce this. So I got a copy of the database from production, because that's where the source of the problem was. My test database when I was developing this application was fairly trivial. I had customers for every employee. Well, that doesn't reflect reality. When real data started to interact with the application, that's where we found I had some employees that didn't have a current customer. I ran into a null situation. So I get a copy of the database, and I run my application. And what I'm hoping to see is the same error, so that I can prove that I do indeed have the error. I'm just going to go to my Reports tab once this comes up. Indeed, there's my null reference exception. So I can continue on with this. I'm just going to take a copy of that URL. Because as a good Agile developer, what I want to do now is I want to create a test to ensure that if this occurs again, I'm going to catch the problem. Now, this isn't going to be quite a unit test, so I'm going to take it up a little bit higher level, and I'm going to use a web test. So I'm going to go down to my test project. I'm going to add a new test. So I use a web performance test. I don't have to be testing performance. And I'm just going to paste in that same URL. So you can see I'm still developing this locally, so I'm using my local code. Start running that, and there indeed is my error message. That's not what I want to see. So I'm going to stop this, and we'll let Visual Studio do some analysis on the HTML that was reported back from my request to the web server. And what I want to do now that I've reproduced the problem using a web test, I actually want to configure the web test to fail under those scenarios. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a new validation rule. And what I want to do is I want to find some text. Now, I've got a very specific string that I render when I run into an error condition. And what I want to do is I just want to see if the word drat appears in my web page. Because if there's a drat, that came from my error message. No customer will ever put in drat. Obviously, you want to make this a little bit more realistic. And if that word is found, we should fail the test. So I'm going to say false to pass if text is found. And I can say OK. Now that I have my test created, let me just run this test. Because when you're doing things like test-driven development or you're creating your unit tests, right, the mantra is red, green, refactor. Right? So start with a failing test. I indeed do have a failing test here. Great. That's where I want to be. So I've got my failing test. I'm going to go back to my code. And like all good developers, I have a snippet. Uh-oh, I don't have a snippet handy. This means I actually have to code for real. So what I want to do is I want to check for a null customer. And if the customer is null, I want to return just a nice simple string that says that there was no customer. So I'm going to say return value equals no customers. And otherwise, I would return what I had in there initially. I can't remember exactly what that whole thing was, so I'm just going to add in, you know, the first name. Oops. Okay, so that should clear up my problem. I'm handling the null case. Let me just do a build. It all built fine. And that's how we used to test our code, right? Did it compile? Yep, it's good, right? Ship it. Well, we're better than that now, so we've got tests.
We're
so much better than that. So I fixed my code. I ran it initially. It failed. I've now got a passing test. This is good. I'm ready to go. I can now check in my code. Okay, so let's go back to Team Explorer. And I want to do a check-in. So here's my pending changes. There we see the change to my C-sharp file and my web test that I've added. And I'm going to say I got fixed null customer. And I'm going to check those changes in. Okay. So let's go and take a look at our builds. Now, of course, I'm a good Agile developer, right? So I've got continuous integration. I've automatically got a build that's kicked off. What I'm going to do now is we're just going to take a look at the definition of this build. And the key here is under the process tab on my build definition. So when you're creating a new build, you'll always have this stuff. And by default, we're going to have index sources set to true. Now, this is moderately specific to TFS, but this should be available in almost all source control systems that are available today. Now, what indexing sources is going to do is every time you do a check-in and do a build, it's going to associate the version of your source control files with the build that was created. Now, what that does is when I take an IntelliTrace file, which was collected from a production system using System Center, we capture metadata out of the binaries that were running in production. We use that metadata to associate back to the matching symbol files, right? Your PDB files. Within the PDB files, this source indexing information is included. So when I start debugging from IntelliTrace, it's going to look for my matching symbols. It'll find my symbol files. I'll show you how to get to that in a second. From the symbol file information, it will contain the information about my TFS server, where it's located, the URL for accessing it. It'll contain the list of files that were compiled into my binaries, along with the version information. So I'll actually pull back the matching version of the source file that was used as part of that build. And it doesn't matter how many times I've changed that source file over time. So the version that Charlie's got in production could be several versions old, and I'm working on version 10 and he's running version 7, it will still pull back the version of the file that was used for his build because I've got source indexing enabled. Now that's on by default. You get that. That's free. The next thing is the tricky one because not enough people set this. We can't set this for you because I don't know what that path needs to be. That's where I'm going to drop my symbol files. Every time a build is compiled, you get those PDB files, right? Those are the magic glue. Within those PDB files is that information about my TFS server, where my source is. every time I do a build, I get a new version of those PDB files, and I have to have the matching version that went with my binaries that I deployed out into production. I don't need to deploy my PDBs. The symbols just need to be stored somewhere where I can find them. Now, in our case here, I've just got these dropping onto the hard drive. Into my symbols location. And what you'll see here is I've got a file folder for every binary that I've compiled. So within my fabricamfiber.web.pdb, you'll see I've got three folders here with GUIDs. So I've actually compiled three times now. Each time I compile, I get a brand new folder in here with a brand new GUID. And that GUID is embedded into the binaries, my DLLs, and into the symbol files. And those things have to match. I load up the symbols from this location. I know how to go and get my source. The other thing that you need to do to make sure that this all works is Visual Studio needs to know about this location. So when I load up my IntelliTrace file and it says, hey, go find me the symbols, the path embedded into the binaries is actually going to be the file location where they were compiled. So that's probably like some R drive on your build server. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go and look in my R drive. Well, I don't have an R drive on my laptop or my dev box, so that's going to fail. And then the next thing that I'm going to do is I'm actually going to start looking for the locations that are configured within my options in Visual Studio. So Visual Studio then starts to go look through these locations. And of course, this doesn't have to be, you know, an absolute path on a drive. This can be to that share location. It just happens to, you know, I'm mapping to the same location. So it's going to go and look in this location for those symbol files. If it finds them, it loads them. The symbol file says, now go to TFS, grab that source file out of there. Okay, so that's some of the magic that's sort of going on behind the scenes, and that's why I was able to get to my source file. Now, the nice thing about that, too, is I could open up the source file for my matching build, and maybe I've already fixed that bug. And I know we just need to deploy a newer build. Okay, so the build is built. The next step, of course, is how do you transition this stuff through into operations. Every organization is different, right? Me and Charlie in our basement working on our little app, well, we're both kind of the QA team. So we'll go and we'll look at it and we'll go, yep, that looks good. Let's push this thing out. But probably in enterprises, that's not really going to be the case. Now, the way we've got our build constructed is we're going to have our build spin up a new VM, a clean VM. We'll use whatever virtualization infrastructure you want to have. Maybe it's the stuff that we're providing with TFS and the build virtualization for testing. You can use PowerShell. If any of you saw the desired state configuration session earlier, we've got amazing support to spin up brand new VMs, configure them with IIS, deploy your application all automatically. So we'll do that as part of the build. New environment, deploy the app, run our tests there, including my web tests. It all passes. Great. Now, we may have an organization that has a QA team. They want to do some manual testing on it first, and we need their blessing before it can go to operations. We can do things like use the state of the build here to signify, yes, this has our blessing, and it's ready for deployment. So in this case, we're going to use these built-in capabilities to indicate that this is ready to go. All right, so that all looks good. The last thing I need to do now is to modify that task. Oops, back to Team Explorer. Go back to my work items. And, oh, it's the one that I was just working on. And it's the one that I accepted. I need to open this up and now say, this is resolved. So my bug is resolved. And it wants to know, who am I going to assign this to? So this is where I would assign it to my network administrators, or if it's a specific person, I would assign it to Charlie directly. And I can say, build and test passed, ready to deploy, and save that off. Wonderful. So I've gotten the data from operations. I've modified everything, I've updated the status, and I've never had to leave Visual Studio. I am a happy developer. All right, Charlie. All deploy right. It! Make it go.
That easy?
That
just
easy.
Deploy it?
Just all deploy right. It.
So, Larry's taken every taking care of everything on the dev side. And now I'm going to quickly go back into Operations Manager to show you one more thing. So Larry already sort of hinted that we bring back some data from TFS. We have the ticket ID column here. You can see now this one is set to resolved, so it must be ready for me to deploy. But let me double-click into here and take a look at the history. You can see here that we actually have the notes from that Team Foundation server work item in this alert now. So we actually have the details in both systems so that that artifact spans into the ops side. All right, so I'll exit out of here. So now I'm ready to go ahead and deploy this. We've done enough testing. So let me switch over to our production server and go to our build folder. And how many of you went to the desired state configuration session or have talked over at the PowerShell booth around this? No?
Fun. Okay. This is some cool stuff.
So I've got a file here, a PowerShell file, that I'll edit just to show you what's going on. We're going to actually run this before we deploy to make sure that our production system matches what Larry was running in dev and test, so that when we deploy, we've got high confidence that it's actually going to work. We're not going to have any issues. So for this, we've actually created a custom module to check for some IIS configuration settings. And we're checking, for instance, for the app name, the physical path. We're looking at things like the framework version, the app pool identity, and the app pool pipeline mode. So at the bottom of this, we've got two different commands. One of them is commented out. The one that we're going to run has a dash what if at the end of it. And what this command will do is actually execute the desired state configuration module, and it will check to make sure that all of the settings are as specified in our file. And if there are any changes or differences that it detects, it'll actually flag it for us so that we can review that before we go ahead and run that final command. That final command actually will implement any changes that are required to get it into that desired state. Now, this is going against my production system. I don't want to do that right now. I just want to understand what the differences are. So I'll go ahead and execute this. And this will spin up. And it's running slower than usual there.
My poor laptop.
All right. Okay. So we actually have some differences here. Apparently, Larry's moving ahead of us in production in his dev environment. He's running the newer version of the .NET framework. He's running 4.0, and in production, apparently, we're only on 2.0. And he's using a different managed pipeline mode in the app pool. He's using integrated, and we're using classic in production. So I think I'm going to hold off moving to production with our code. This could be an issue. So, Larry, I think we need to go back and review this.
I already went all the way back to 4.0. We got 4.5.1 out now.
I know, but we're in production. We don't make changes quickly.
You're killing me here.
And we actually have a few other apps that are running on this box. I don't want to make any changes that might break those.
So nobody's run into this before, right? Everybody, you know, the devs are on like 4.5.1, awesome, it's out, I got to use the new stuff. It's got this new keyword that I can, it cuts development time in half. I mean, it's
really
keywords? I'm so much more productive. Well, yes.
Okay.
Keywords. Okay, you guys know what I'm talking about, right? Because this is a dev crowd. Yes, give me the latest stuff. And then ops guy says 2.0. All right. You're right.
Yes.
You're right. You're ops. Ops is always right. We all know that. Okay. So we use this watch the recording for desired state configuration. The capabilities behind this stuff is amazing. So what you noticed is Charlie picked up this file from the drops. So I'm going to switch back to my development VM here, which is kind of doubling up as our monitoring VM. And I'm going to go back into Solution Explorer. Now, you'll see as part of my solution, I've got this DSC PowerShell file included. Now, what this is this is all about configuration as code. This is going to help us push code into production faster than we could before. Now, as part of our builds, it's easy to execute PowerShell. So we're executing PowerShell using this new DSC, desired state configuration capabilities, to configure our environments. So DSC takes care of spinning up the VM, adding IIS, deploying my application. And it's doing that based on this file. This is what I need to do. I need to say, hey, this is what I want my server to look like. And it goes, okay, no problem. It's a very declarative kind of thing where you just have to say, this is what I want. I want this. I want this. I want this. I want whatever capabilities installed and configured. DSC will take care of ordering them correctly so that they run in the correct order. So I could have this IIS feature thing below this configure the website thing. And as it looks at it, it goes, oh, no, I need IIS before I can actually configure it. And it'll take care of that for you. But since I'm using this as part of my build and spinning up my environment, and this is what my tests are running in, my tests are running against 4.0 of the framework. And Charlie says that we're not quite ready to do that in production, so I'm going to change that to 2.0. And I was also testing against an IIS integrated configured pipeline. And that needs to be the classic pipeline because we have some other applications that are still relying on the classic mode. So I make my changes to my DSC. In conjunction with Charlie. He knows his environment. I don't know how he's got his servers configured, so we work together to define this. But then I take advantage of it in my development, my test environments. So I can now check this in. So I want to update my DSC for prod. Check those in. And of course, this is going to spin off another build. We'll go through another round of testing. Now, what this has done is this is, and of course, you know, if I've changed framework versions, I'm probably going to have to modify my app. I'm going to have to change the definition of my app. But if we had just taken that application and dropped it onto our production servers, and it's a nice simple app, I can X-copy this, it would have failed. Tests all passed. Everything seemed fine. Why is it failing in production? It's configured different. It's right? We've all had those challenges. Your staging environment isn't quite the same. So with this file, we can guarantee that our environments are going to match. I can rerun my tests. I can modify my code to make sure that it's going to run on 2.0. And then once I've got all of that stuff passed, I can say, OK, Charlie, we've got a matching environment. We followed the DSD configuration. Everything's passed again. We should be good to go.
Great.
Try that again.
So he ran a new build. He's tested it. Now I get to go ahead and try the DSC against the production server. Oop, wrong box. One more time just to validate that, yes, indeed, he did make those changes. So let me go to the new drop that we put out there. And again, I'll open up my DSC PowerShell file. And, yep, I can see he's made the change. Framework version is 2.0, and the pipeline mode is set to classic. So now if I execute this one, it should go ahead and pass. And, yep, no, it did pass. So I can go ahead and deploy this code out and resolve this issue once and for all. Now, the one thing I noticed, now that we're up and running and fine, you created a test, a web performance test in Visual Studio.
I be an agile developer. I'm a good boy. Yes, I did.
So did you know that with the GSM service, Global Service Monitoring Service, I now have the ability, or we have the capability, of taking those Visual Studio web tests and executing those from external watcher nodes?
Tell me it's not true.
Our sales job is very, very good.
We have to entertain ourselves up here as well, right? That's cool. Tell me more.
Yes. So with 2012 SP1 and signing up for Global Service Monitor, I can now actually go into the authoring workspace, and I can set up a Visual Studio test web test monitor. I could take that test that he created. I'd have to change out the URLs, because he's executing against an internal server and I need to execute against our public-facing app. But I could go ahead and select Visual Studio Web Test Monitoring in the wizard. I will test for DRAT as the name for my monitor. I'll add this to my web monitoring management pack. And this is the screen when I showed you the web app availability monitor. This is where you would add in one or more URLs to monitor. Now, in this screen, I'm able to actually click Add and select one or more web test files to add. So I could add many different web test files to this monitor and upload those to be individually executed by Global Service Monitor. So if I click Next, hopefully you didn't have any, So one of the caveats, you got to make sure that the think time parameters between steps in that web test file are set to zero. Otherwise, it will fail on upload. But I have the identical list of external locations to select from. One thing you'll notice, if I cancel out of here, I don't have an option to execute this from an internal resource. I can only execute these tests from external resources. And if I wanted to do something similar from an internal resource, I'd need to use the old school application transaction monitors that's been in Operation Manager for a while. But with the new Visual Studio web tests, I can actually take that transaction and that test in production concept comes alive with that.
So this is really showing how developer assets that I'm using to test my code, we can reuse in System Center. Mm-hmm. I can rerun the same tests. And of course, that web test, I may have hit multiple pages. I may have actually interacted with things. They can be much more complex than simply hit a page and look for a string value. And reuse those assets to test in production so that I can really start to catch errors within, like those logic errors, those things that aren't throwing, you know, an exception or whatever that the other tools, the APM, wouldn't catch. I can catch those now with these tests in a very logic manner and inform us when something is going wrong. Mm-hmm. That the only other way we would typically find out is when a customer phoned up and said, hey, I tried to do this thing and now I'm getting the wrong values back, or I'm getting the wrong experience. So this can test workflows as well as just simple scenarios like what we were showing here.
Yes. So,
cool.
I think we've actually come full circle on that chart.
I think so. This is nice.
Why don't we switch back over? And let's just review it for a second. So what did we start off with? So we actually integrated our workflows. So we're able to actually transfer items and data between Operation Manager and Team Foundation Server. So we're all working off of an integrated backlog. Next, we're able to actually take the tests that Larry created during his agile development and run those in production using Visual Studio Web Tests. And then leveraging application performance monitoring, we're actually able to do non-intrusive diagnostics. We're actually able to profile and get the exception data and the call stacks and IntelliTrace logs and provide all that data over to our dev team. Not only all that data just for that one particular issue, but we have tools in Operations Manager now that will allow us to quickly, at a glance, determine where to spend our dev dollars. We can actually look across the applications like Microsoft.com is using for APM, and they're actually able to say, all right, these two applications are causing 80% of our pain. We can go spend our dev dollars on fixing issues with those applications. And then once we've handed off over to dev,
yeah.
Larry.
So you saw with the IntelliTrace files, I'm getting right to the line of code where the exception was thrown. What I didn't show you is a lot of the additional data that gets captured as well. So if, as part of that exception, we had hit a database, some of the additional data that we capture is the SQL statement that was executed, along with the parameter values that were used to execute that SQL statement. Things like this can be really, really valuable so that you can actually understand what were the values submitted by the user that resulted in either a long-running query or a poor query, something that returned null values. So we've got a lot of very, very rich data. It becomes very actionable. It's actually captured in production, so I've got the same data that the user was using when they encountered the problem. So we've got actionable feedback, I've got data from production, and then as we use things like DSC, and hopefully you've heard the announcement that we made at TechEd in New Orleans with the acquisition of the in-release product, we're enabling a whole lot of workflow capabilities for how you move through the different stages of your different environments and whatever the workflow is through your QA teams and helping to deploy the bits. Coupling that with the DSC, we now have a very rich deployment story moving forward. So that's been very, very helpful.
Excellent.
So we've got some great solutions. Visual Studio, System Center. We're continuing to work and add a lot of capabilities between those two so that you can talk back and forth. TFS, we got the PowerShell, all of that stuff that we just talked about. I've got a little bit of time left. So what I do want to show you, one thing I should say, everything that we've shown here is available today. So this is all available with Service Pack 1 of System Center.
Yep.
And Visual Studio 2012 Update 2. This is where all of these capabilities are available. What I do want to show you, if we can just switch back to the demo machine for a moment, is something that we've got coming up with... I want to cancel. With 2013. So what we showed is Charlie assigned an exception event in System Center to engineering, and we had an IntelliTrace file attached.
An application failure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. If it had been a performance failure and he assigned it to engineering, there would be no IntelliTrace file because we don't have conversion of the performance gathered data into an IntelliTrace format. We're adding that, so that will be available with System Center R2 and Visual Studio 2013. So those, I believe, are now available for download in a preview form, and you can start to take a look at that. And what I've got here is just some samples. So let me pick one. And this user interface is going to change, so don't be concerned that it's actually showing up as web requests. There will be a performance data section that these will appear under. And when I drill into these, you'll now see the performance data that was captured from System Center. So this is not using Visual Studio tools to capture the data. It's System Center APM data that we're converting into a format that IntelliTrace can understand. And we've got all of the slowest node stuff where we can expand out and we can drill down into these things. And here I can show you some of the rich data that we capture. Let me collapse this section, give us a little more real estate. So you can see I've got the SQL statement that was executed. I can drill into the parameters, and I can actually see the values of the parameters that were passed in my production system that was captured by System Center, all exported into Visual Studio. And then what I can do is I can start to look at some of these things. Let me see if I can pick a good one. So let's try this one. I'm going risky here, so we'll see what happens. Now, this is a very common experience when you're dealing with IntelliTrace. So remember what I was showing you before, right? I'd start double-clicking on an exception, and code pops up. Code popped up because Visual Studio knew where to go and look for the symbol files. Those symbol files said, this is where your code was. Now, all of this data was gathered on some other machine, someplace else, and it was not on this box. So quite often what you're going to get is you're going to get this petshop.sqlserver.dell.pdb.not_loaded. This is saying Visual Studio couldn't find those symbol files. I don't know where they are. Now, you're given this load button. Let me just back up a second. If what it says up here is something like system.web.pdb, don't worry about it. That's Microsoft code that you're trying to debug. We don't give away that much of our code, so you're probably not going to be able to debug it. If it's looking like this, where you're going, yeah, that's my code, you should have those symbols saved. If you haven't saved the symbols, you're kind of stuck here. However, even if you are stuck, if you start to look at the locals, and this is probably a bad example, well, there I can hover over this. You can see I do have a lot of data captured that you can still look at and you can still inspect and understand what went on. But I can load my matching symbols. So I'm just going to go up to where I've got this stored. And it was hard to see because it flashed very quickly. It actually found my symbol files. And what's happened is it's now switched over and it says, I'm now looking for the source file. Because you can see it's actually looking now for item.cs. So it loaded up the symbols and it went, oh, for that particular line of code, that's contained in your item.cs file. I don't know where that is because this wasn't built with TFS. I didn't have source indexing. So what it went and looked for is the same location wherever this code was compiled. And it was compiled on some other guy's machine. I don't know what drive it's looking for, but it's not finding it there. So now I can actually go back, and I have a copy of the source. And I can drill down into my SQL Server DAL folder. Oh, except maybe I don't have that one. This is where it gets a little tricky. No, I must have it if I've got the source. Maybe it's here. Okay. So within that folder was that item.cs file. As soon as I found the folder where that source file was contained, it loaded up the source file. And it's put the line, it set the debugger onto the line where that method was executed. So I kind of wanted to show you a few different things with that last little bit. We've got performance data coming from System Center now. So that will appear System Center R2 Visual Studio 2013. It's now giving you that hot path. Here's the slowest nodes. Here's some very rich data that we've got. And I also wanted to show you what's that experience if Visual Studio doesn't know where to automatically look and load your symbols. When you get that no symbols found screen, don't worry. You can do stuff with it as long as you've saved your matching symbol files. So all is not lost when you get that screen. It's a non-intuitive screen, so I want to make sure that you understood how you actually go and find the symbols, and then you can browse to source. And now I'm looking at my source files. So that's all of this experience with the symbols and all that carries back. It's just that new performance data that's coming new. So that is, I think that's the only other thing that I wanted to show. Okay. Just switch back to our deck. All right. Now, unfortunately, this is the same deck. They just moved the decks from New Orleans to Madrid. So these are the related sessions. So ignore the time. But these are the sessions that were run in New Orleans. Not all of them are repeated here, but they're all definitely recorded and available on Channel 9 if you wanted to go and watch them. The one thing that you're probably very interested in are a deeper dive into using the web requests and the APM that Charlie just alluded to. So he has an entire session from New Orleans that dives deep, as well as some of that PowerShell desired state configuration. So they had a session here as well as New Orleans. Of course, these will all be available on Channel 9, so you can watch the recordings as well. And I will be at the Visual Studio ALM booth tomorrow at 2:30. All right. Feel free to email us if you have any questions. Otherwise, we've got some folks with microphones. If you have questions now, please feel free to chime in.
Questions?
Or if you're desperate for a drink, drinks will be starting soon.
We have one here.
Hi. Just one question. You've got the desired state configuration. That's a file that's under source control and everything that comes with your build. All the monitoring rules that you've got in Operations Manager, is that also under source control, and does that come with the build, for example?
So you could certainly enlist that in your process. Currently, no. Our process doesn't, but there's no reason you couldn't export your management packs and keep those changes. It's just you wouldn't be making those changes necessarily in Visual Studio.
Great question.
Does this require a special version of Visual Studio, a special SKU?
So IntelliTrace is only available with Visual Studio Ultimate. So to analyze the IntelliTrace files, you do need Ultimate. And the performance is 2013. All of the other capabilities were 2012 update 2 for the exported data for application failures from System Center. With 2012 RTM, we released an IntelliTrace standalone collector, which you can download for free and use to collect data off of any server that you want and then open it up in RTM. But it is Ultimate Edition.
Other questions?
Okay. Well, if that's it, I want to thank everybody for coming out and enjoy the drinks tonight.